What I want to do to start with is say where I think we are. When I say we, I mean libertarians, I mean conservatives, classical liberals. They stole our word on the left. The left, especially in its modern incarnation, is not liberal at all. Progressive is a bit of a better word, but they're not really progressive either. Platform, not just from Bernie Sanders, but from Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama as well, is largely rooted in the 1930s. So whatever you are, if you are against that, I think we're not doing as badly as has been reported. It is easy to presume otherwise for two reasons. Firstly, the press, when President Obama was re-elected, did what it always does, which is to say, that's it for the right, that's it for the liberty movement. The future is forever to be run by progressivism. Of course, it did the same thing in 2004 when Bush was re-elected, but the other way around. That was the end of the Democratic Party, that was the end of progressivism. That's what the press does. And it, because we focus so much, I think dangerously so, on the presidency, it can seem that all is lost if the White House is lost. Well, that's not the way it is, and it's not the way it should be. Secondly, it can seem depressing when the primary is thus far being won by someone who is in no ways a classical liberal or a libertarian or really a conservative. Donald Trump is not what I would think of when I thought of the word liberty, individual freedom, constitutionalism, free markets even. He is something of a crony capitalist. So it can be depressing. And the third reason it's depressing is that Obama has made some changes. I mean, the country has changed in some ways for the worse in the last 8 years, 7 years. He has done a lot of damage with executive action, and that, it should be said, is not entirely his doing. That's also Congress's doing, because Congress is weak. It's also the way that American politics has been going for a very long time, under President Reagan, under President Bush. But there has been some damage. The good news is that nothing that the president has done seems necessarily permanent. I mean, Obamacare is not a popular program. Now, in my country of birth, the National Health Service is something akin to a religion. You cannot criticize it. Everybody hates it, but it is sacrosanct. It's an odd paradox. That hasn't happened in the United States, and that's a good thing. Nevertheless, it is still the law. So we are in an odd position, but not a fatal position. Now, the problem for conservatives is that although we have won back a great deal of public offices, and although Obama has not done what he set out to do, and I'll dwell on that for a moment. He hasn't set out what he done what he set out to do. When he was running for president, he took something of a swipe at Bill Clinton. He said that Bill Clinton had not been a transformational president in the way that Ronald Reagan had, that he'd been too obsessed with school uniforms and small ball, but that he, Barack Obama, would be, that he would realign the American polity toward progressivism. And toward collectivism. I don't believe he's done that. If you look at the exit polls from 2012, there is very little evidence that he has done that. The only area in which he substantially beat Mitt Romney, who was no libertarian either, but was on the question of cares about you, there was no ideological realignment there in the way there was under Reagan. To see how much it changed under Reagan. Note that when he came into office in 1980, he had a 15-point Democratic registration disadvantage, and when he left, it was 2. And that's a big change. President Obama has really presided over the opposite, not in terms of registration, but certainly in terms of political power. In Washington, Republicans have the largest majorities in the House they've had since the 20s. They control the Senate. And the states control more governorships and state legislatures than they have for a very long time. And depending on how Anthony Kennedy feels, in the morning. They have a slim advantage on the Supreme Court. That is promising, but it's not really the whole ball game, because everyone hates conservatives too. And it is a different proposition to be anti-Obama than it is to be pro-liberty. Now, we have not reached a place where a majority is pro-liberty. Now, one of the reasons I would wager that Republicans are unpopular is that their own supporters, or their own traditional supporters, also dislike them. And when you see favorability ratings for the party, of course you have people who disagree ideologically with what the party purports to stand for. But you also have people who are supposed to be in favor of it, but are extremely angry with it. Now, this is not the product of President Obama. It's not because President Obama is black. This started in 2005, 2006. It started because a good number of people on the right were disappointed with what Republicans, and rightfully disappointed with what Republicans did last time they were in power. It started because of TARP. It started because the Republicans did not put up the opposition they should have in the early Obama years. In fact, if you review the Bush years, there are many actions that were taken with unified Republican government that were simply unforgivable. Now, I am willing, although I am a critic of the Iraq War, I am willing to give Bush a little latitude in this area because circumstances changed. It's absolutely right to say that back in 2000, when running for president, he said that he would preside over a humble foreign policy and nation building would not be any part of it. And then, of course, did precisely the opposite. But he did not expect 9/11. And as much as it is politically easy to say Bush's war, it was America's war. It was an American mistake. 75% support. Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, supported it, and I don't believe that Al Gore would have made a different call in that environment. Fair enough. So if we're being generous, we can say, well, some of the mistakes that we now see were driven by events. But that doesn't explain why, when Republicans had the chance, they passed Medicare Part D in the middle of the night by leaving the vote open for an hour and a half until they got enough yeses. We didn't have to do that because the Twin Towers came down. Now, that was a choice. Likewise, that doesn't explain why No Child Left Behind was passed. That did not need to be passed in order to take care of Afghanistan. That was a choice. And it was a cynical choice. It was precisely the sort of choice that people on the right tend to slam people on the left for making. Bush looked at his election in 2000, which he, in popular terms, lost. He won the election, but he lost the popular vote. And he thought, well, where can I shore up support? And he thought from suburban families and older voters who at that point were leaning Democratic. So you get Medicare Part D, and you get No Child Left Behind. It shouldn't be a surprise that there are a good number of people on the right who look at those years and say, well, I don't like this party either. What does this party actually stand for? And who are worried that if there is another unified right-leaning government in 2016, that they'll make exactly the same mistakes. There's obviously a problem somewhere. Now, I mention this to set the scene. I don't think things are as bad as they have been suggested. It's been suggested that they are, but I don't think that we should take too much heart from the recent victories, because there's a big difference between winning political victories and winning policy victories, and we haven't won too many of those. But what I think Republicans need to do, what I think they need to focus on, what I think conservatives need to focus on, is restoring an old, a foundational American value. Not only to fix themselves and to fix the right in general, but to fix the country. I think what ails the right, in some ways, ails the whole country, and that's this. Charles Murray wrote an excellent column recently in commentary, in which he suggested that the America of 2015, published last year, is more akin in nature to the America of 1915 than to 1960. And what he meant by that was that back in 1915, you had a genuinely diverse public. Now, I don't mean racially, it's really irrelevant. I mean religiously, politically, socially, geographically. You had a diverse and divergent population. Whereas in 1960, the country was more unicultural. Not entirely unicultural, of course, but unicultural nevertheless. A country in which you had three television stations, a country in which you could pretty much guarantee that the person you saw the next day at work would have seen the same TV shows as you, or at least some of them. A country that was not deeply divided over political premises in the way that we are now, and in the way we were in 1915. The 1960 election probably felt important at the time, but if you look back at it now, and you actually look at the positions that Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy held, there was a remarkable level of comity. Now, why does this matter? Well, it matters because at the exact moment that Americans have not only returned to their more divided and more localist roots, we have also been liberated by technology. We have reached a point at which the need for a big, centralized, forceful government has become diminished. We now have the internet, we now have Uber, we now have, or will have, self-driving cars. The barriers to entry are so low in so many sectors, and yet at that exact moment we have developed a penchant for centralization and for elevating every question to the national level. Now, I don't know where you all come down on the following question, and I imagine there will be some disagreement in the room, but the fact that the country writ large spent a month or so debating Indiana's religious freedom restoration law is utterly absurd. It was day in, day out of people in Brooklyn who would never come to Indiana if you paid them, saying that they were going to boycott the place. It was day in, day out of a small pizza owner saying in theory they wouldn't cater a gay wedding, being held up as the end of the United States as we know it. Now, that example is one of many. We now tend to elevate all of our questions nationally. This is a huge mistake, and it's a huge problem. And I think, increasingly, it is threatening the social fabric in the United States. It's certainly threatening business and civil society, but it's also threatening the social fabric. The aim, I presume, is to live in a country in which the Baptist in Mississippi and the hipster in Brooklyn can thrill to the same flag, can both love being Americans. If that's going to be the case, given that they have very, very little in common now, I was going to say they have the same language, but even that I think is untrue. If they aren't a thrill to the same flag, they're going to have to enjoy some latitude. Now, I don't see a great movement within the Republican Party, and often within the right, to institute that latitude. In fact, I see a great deal of national talk. I see lip service paid to federalism and localism and constitutional principles. But I don't see enough real action. And I think that's because we've come to forget why the federal system exists in the first place. Now, you'll often hear it said, I think this is a quote from Justice Brandeis, that the states are good, that federalism is good, that localism is good, because they allow for experimentation. The idea being that, well, we'll try it out in Indiana, and then if we like it, we'll try and get 51% of the national polity to agree, and then we'll impose it upon everybody. Well, that can be useful. There are certain circumstances in which you want to try out ideas locally. I, for example, think that the drug war needs rethinking. happy to answer questions about that at the end. And I would like to see that tried slowly at the local level. I think it's a good thing that two or three states are experimenting with this rather than immediately a national law being forthcoming. So yes, it can be useful, but that's not why the federal system exists. James Madison did not sit down and say, well, wouldn't it be great if we could experiment on the people and then nationalize the plans? He was working in a difficult environment. The founders were unsure as to whether a single federal government, even one with limited powers, and far more limited powers than it has now, could work in a country as diverse as it was in 1789. Could the Northeastern Puritans live with the Pennsylvania Quakers? Could they live with the Southern slave owners? Could they live with the Tennessee, the Tennessee Scots-Irish? That was not an obviously answered question back then, and so they came to the conclusion that on most questions, the local people should get to decide. Now, I imagine the elephant in the room, as it should be, is that on some of those questions, the decisions that were taken were abhorrent. This is, of course, America's original sin. The original sin of my home country is class, and the original sin of the United States is race. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that individual rights or dignity should be sacrificed in the name of localism. That would be wrong, and it would be folly. And by that, of course, I don't just mean civil rights, I mean individual rights too. It cannot be the case that in the name of diversity we permit Massachusetts to ban free speech. It cannot be the case that in the name of diversity we allow California to undermine the Second Amendment. But on the vast majority of questions that affect people, housing, transportation, education, zoning, healthcare, the fact that we have attempted to constrain the market, to constrain individuals, to constrain civil society, and to impose one-size-fits-all policies is absurd. And it's not just absurd, and it's not just damaging comity, but it's making people less good citizens than they would be otherwise. In Democracy in America, de Tocqueville talks about the New England townships. Now, in our modern age, when we quote de Tocqueville on the New England townships, we tend to make the case that they were a good thing because people were close to their representatives, and that's true. One of the big problems that we have now is that the vast majority of decisions on which you are asked to vote don't affect you at all. So if you vote for somebody, this is no indictment of you or the politicians in question, but if you vote for somebody you like, you are maybe going to see 2, 3, 4 results from that person. And many of those results will be indirect because the bureaucracy is so big. So you're sitting in Indiana and you're voting effectively at the next election on what the regulations governing Oregon logging will be. A question that really has nothing to do with you, and a question I imagine very few of you know anything about. There's no one in the world who is clever enough or has enough time to learn every single question before us. So yes, it is good for people to be near their representatives. But why? Why? Well, because if they can see the consequences of their actions, then they learn. Then they learn how politics works. And they, oddly enough, become closer to those around them because those around them are being directly affected by their actions, which is why if a town in New England cut school funding and the kids became stupid, they noticed. It's why if you cut your streetlight budget and everyone starts bumping into each other in the dark, you notice. Now, this is not how our politics works at the moment. And as such, we've become oddly ignorant. Two-thirds of Americans, and I'm always aware when I make this comment that I'm speaking to people who are by definition politically involved, and this always elicits gasps because you're here on a weeknight listening to me, so you have an interest. But two-thirds of Americans do not know what the three branches of government are. They can't name them. Two-thirds. That is a problem, especially when those two-thirds of government, when those three branches of government have so much power. It wouldn't matter otherwise. So we've got ourselves into quite a difficult situation. Now, I think at this point, progressives usually say to me, well, that sounds very interesting, but isn't localism and smaller government and a less fettered free market just what you want? Isn't that a bit of a convenient argument to be making, that you think that that's the way the country's moving when that's exactly what you want? And that's true, of course. There's an ideological component here. But oddly enough, Americans of all sorts have come to feel this way. Back in 2003, the federal, local, and state governments had a similar approval rating. It was about 55%. So you had federal government 55%, state government 55%, local government 55%. Now it is heavily stratified. Now the federal government has an approval rating of about 35%, and now the state governments have an approval rating of about 55%, and local governments have an approval rating of 65%. Now that's instructive. That shows us something important. And even more instructive is that that's not broken down in a partisan way, at least not outside of the federal government. Both Democrats and Republicans, progressives, conservatives, libertarians, they like their local government the most, then they like their state government, then they like the federal government. Now, who likes the federal government changes depending on who the president is, as you'd imagine. But that's the whole point. You don't want your institutions to depend for their integrity upon who happens to be in them at any given moment. And that is unfortunately where we've got to the extent that if we wake up on November, whatever it is, 8th, 9th, this year, and discover that, say, Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders has been elected president, a lot of us are going to spend at least 4 years in something of a funk. Maybe we will help this bar stay in business. If, on the other hand, we wake up and we find that Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio, or God forbid Donald Trump, is president, the left is going to spend 4 years in a funk. It's going to be all-out war. Again, that doesn't make a great deal of sense. It's important. It will always be important who is the president. But it should not be the be-all and the end-all. In fact, there are, of course, areas in which you cannot have a local focus. The military has to be national. You don't want to give Andrew Cuomo tanks. Immigration has to be national. You have one state with open borders. They all have open borders. Regardless of what one thinks of open borders, it's an inherently national question. And as I say, civil rights and individual rights are. But we seem to be sleepwalking into the acceptance of an elected dictatorship where whomever is the president gets to set the tone. And as I say, I'm not just opposed to that on constitutional grounds, but I think that on national comity grounds, it's going to be seriously problematic. And it's also going to ruin the heart of American progress and American success, which has always been small business and civil society. I've said for a while that you can tell to what extent the government has grown too big by how many laws you need to exempt the Amish from. That's a serious point, though. It's a serious point. If you had said in 1870 to an average lawmaker, so there's this group of religious people who want to live in the country and be largely left alone, they have beards and they have traditional values, but they don't want anything, they just want to be left alone. And the lawmaker would have said, yeah, that's everyone in the country, right? But now, it's genuinely fascinating. Now it is completely the opposite. Look at laws that are passed nationally and find the section in which the Amish are either named or effectively named and exempted. In other words, find the laws that stop people from saying, I don't wish to be part of this national scheme, but I also don't want anything from you. They are everywhere. There is an Amish exemption to environmental regulations. There's an Amish exemption to Obamacare. There are Amish exemptions to school regulations and national curricula, or at least money that goes to schooling. That's a terrifying thing when you stop and think about it. And one of the reasons that Obamacare has been so controversial is because for the first time in American history, it makes a claim on you purely for existing. You don't have to do anything in order for it to kick in. Now, it's not to say there wasn't big government before. It's not to say it's the worst big government program in American history. Of course it's not. Beforehand, you had to make money before you were taxed. You had to open a business before it was regulated. You had to drive on the public roads before you needed a license. You had to take the gun outside of your house into public land before you needed a concealed carry permit, and so on and so forth. But this law makes a claim on you just for existing. And that's frankly incompatible with a country that values civil society and values localism. If people can't opt out, then they are ultimately not free. I want to finish by suggesting that as conservatives, and I include myself in this, as libertarians, we do not do a particularly good job of making that case to people who don't already agree with us. And I'll give you an example. Take the contraception mandate. Now, I'm staunchly opposed to the contraception mandate, but because of the mandate bit, not the contraception bit. And in fact, if you look at polling on this, Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and progressives, tend to have similar opinions on contraception per se. 87% of Republicans say they're fine with contraception, 90% of Democrats do. It's a statistically insignificant difference. Where they differ immensely is on the question of mandates. Now, we didn't focus in on that and try to make our case. What we should have said is this. I don't really care what you do with your life, but I don't want government mandates because they impinge upon people who have different views. And then we should have used an example from our own side. I think guns would have been a good one, not just because I'm a Second Amendment guy, but because I think it's a hot-button topic that is similar to contraception and exciting passions. It is possible. That's not cool to use guns as contraception, of course. Just to clarify. Many conservatives believe that the concealed carry regime, that the proliferation of guns, is not merely correlated to the reduction in crime, which has been remarkable, but is in part the cause of it. Now, without getting into that, that is a position that is held on the right. You could therefore make the case, if you thought, as do those who put out their mandates, that people should be armed, that there is a public interest in arming people. And you could say, under a Ted Cruz administration, well, we're going to put forward a gun mandate in order to increase public safety. Now, as a guy who has six guns and is big into the right to keep and bear arms, I would oppose that, and I'd oppose it vehemently, because I don't want people who have a moral problem or an ethical problem or a personal problem to be forced to buy a private product, and I also don't want them to have to keep things in their home that they don't want there. It's a mandate point. We didn't make that case. We didn't use that analogy. What we said, and I'm no political genius, but I don't think this was particularly smart, is why do you need contraception anyway, you slut? Which didn't really help. There's a better argument, which is, I don't think that the federal government should be going after a group called Little Sisters of the Poor. I mean, when you actually look at what happened here, the fact that the Obama administration went after Little Sisters of the Poor was all the ammunition that we needed on that question, and yet we chose the wrong avenue. Another example of this relates to drugs. And now, Oregon, Colorado, and Washington State have all legalized marijuana recently. I do not think the federal government should be refusing to enforce the laws that they're breaking. I think the federal government should repeal those laws. But either way, the case that was made, and people voted with their feet, in Washington and in Oregon and in Colorado, was that the federal laws are wrong. That's what they said by passing those initiatives. Now, when we talk to the people who voted for those laws, and there are some of us on the right who would have voted for those laws as well, but they did skew left and young. When we talk to those people, we tend to say, we want local government and local power and a thriving federal system because it's good for business and because of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and Edmund Burke and the little platoons. And we speak in this language that we all understand, but that many, many people on the other side who instinctively disagree with us on those questions do not. Again, what we should be saying is, hold on a moment, the only reason that your experiment in Colorado and Washington and Oregon it has been able to survive is because Loretta Lynch has woken up in a good mood since she has been appointed and then pushed through. If she wanted to, she could wake up tomorrow morning and start enforcing the laws in those states. And because the Supreme Court, in one of the worst decisions, and I'm a big fan of Antonin Scalia in general, but this was a disaster, because the Supreme Court has given the go-ahead, there's nothing those states could do. I would be saying to them, hey, you could see Chris Christie in the White House, and he will enforce those laws and hard. And then I would be making the case that maybe we should come to some sort of arrangement where, all right, you get to have your experiment, and look, the majority in Mississippi is not going to agree with you, but that's fine, it's your state, Colorado is a different state. But then in other areas, we would quite like to have our own liberty because that is not, you know, we have different values too. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that Americans will rise up as one and say, yes, I am now a libertarian federalist. But I do think that the number of people who are genuinely interested in foisting their own view of the good life on every single person in this country is limited to maybe 25% of the population. And I think the number of people who are genuinely interested in what the Constitution says and how the country should be set up is probably 25% of the population as well. There is a big group in the middle, and we have to do a much better job at explaining to them why we believe what we believe. Because if we don't, and if we end up with another administration like this one, or indeed, which would be much worse for conservatism in the long term, a president on the right who comes in and decides that he's going to impose his own conception of the good life, then I think the country is going to be torn apart. And on that uplifting note, I'll take any questions you might have.
So with the importance of local control, how would you make that sell to a place that suffered from local control so much as Flint?
Well, the first thing to say with that is that you need to highlight who's to blame in Flint. I mean, yes, Flint is terribly mismanaged, but it hasn't been mismanaged by Republicans, right? It's been mismanaged by Democrats. Now, if people in that place want to be mismanaged by Democrats, to an extent, that's their own funeral. The right, the greatest right you can have in a free country is the right to be wrong. And I think once we acknowledge that, then you tend to end up in a good place on most questions, right? I mean, where I'm from, there are speech laws, hate speech laws, and that tends to be defined arbitrarily and capriciously in the moment. In a sense, what the British government has said is that we do not believe that people have the right to be wrong. So when somebody says the Holocaust didn't happen, sure, they're an idiot. But you're allowed to be an idiot. Free men are allowed to be idiots. So Flint. I do think that the biggest challenge here is not places like Flint. I think the biggest challenge here is the history of localism and the history of so-called states' rights is inextricable from the history of race violations. Now, that doesn't necessarily have to be the case, of course. We tend to balk a little bit in America at the word secession. We tend to balk a little bit at the word states' rights because they have often been used for ill. But again, that's not written in stone. Actually, secession can be a good thing. It wasn't in that case, in my view, and nor was the way in which state power was used. But when it comes to the people in Colorado, as I say, who are standing up for their right to smoke weed or their right to agree as a majority to allow weed to be bought, I mean, they're exercising states' rights too. And funnily enough, the biggest secession movement in the country is in Vermont, not in Texas, which would be probably a good option if Bernie Sanders got in when the White House. So yeah, I mean, it's going to be difficult. But again, changing the way in which people think about local control will be important. And the great challenge here is going to come when the left no longer controls the White House. And when the left no longer controls the White House, that's when you pounce and make your case. Look, don't you want to have more power? Don't you want to be able to opt out? But it's a very, very difficult thing. I'm not going to pretend that it's not going to take years and years and years. My instinct is, my prediction is, that it is increasingly going to be the case that people want local control over their lives. Because, you know, if you look at young people on the left, they don't like those states and municipalities that are banning Uber either. Now, when that comes to the national level, when these questions come to the national level, they're not necessarily going to side with progressivism. I mean, Hillary Clinton said that if she's elected, she's going to look into Uber. She said this about 2 or 3 months ago. It's not necessarily the case that younger people, younger progressives, will side with that. So you have to pick your fights, I suppose, is my answer.
With that advocacy of sort of localized government as an agent of political change, isn't that where power is most concentrated and little fiefdoms are created, though? Like in with Kim Davis in Kentucky, you find nepotism is just rampant at the local level, and regardless of election outcome, it's just a matter of time before someone gets a role for life and ends up going along to get along because of the job security.
Yeah, that will happen. I mean, that human... I'm pretty sure we will agree on this, that human nature is largely fixed, and that there are no solutions, only trade-offs. Kim Davis is an odd example because she was in direct defiance of a court order. And I will bow to no man on my support for religious liberty, but she was breaking the law, and she was not really a martyr of religious liberty because she was in a government position. Had she been minding her own business and they'd come to her house and said, you have to take the cross out or you have to go and marry these people over in the court, well, obviously she would have been, she'd have had her rights violated. But you don't have a right to defy a court order while a government employee. So she's in a little category of her own. But yes, you're going to get little fiefdoms. But the great advantage of subsidiarity is that you limit the damage that those fiefdoms can do, and providing that enough people dislike the consequences of that fiefdom, they can move. And something that's interested me recently is the degree to which we actually have any real experimentation on taxes in the United States. I mean, you see Florida and Texas saying, come to Florida and Texas, we have no income tax. It's not true, of course, they have no state income tax. And so they may very well contrast their state with a state like California, where the top rate is 13%. And if you're in California and you make a lot of money, it may be attractive to move to Texas. But they're not trying to see what happens at zero. I mean, every law that the federal government passes and every tax the federal government implements creates a new baseline that you can't escape. And so the fiefdoms that you're describing are always going to grow up. You're going to get bad local government. As I say, people have the right to be wrong. But you are permitting people a chance to get away from it. And there's a downside to this argument that I accept, and I make this point in my book. Conservatives should talk more compassionately about this. Not everyone can move. So if it really, really is terrible to be in a particular state, the poorest people are going to suffer from that. You should acknowledge that. And again, with trade-off, Texas has done extraordinarily well at creating jobs. It's done very, very well at creating prosperity, has cheap housing, has cheap gas. But it also has fewer social services than a state like Massachusetts. So if you are a poor person, you're more likely to get out of that trap but you also are going to see some people stuck in it. So the fiefdom is point is a problem because people will be stuck. But at the same time, people are moving. I mean, I was looking at the internal migration numbers last week, and it's quite remarkable. Florida had 200,000 people move there last year. Now, the nearest state was 60,000. The only reason that it was Colorado, the only reason that, because of the week, the only reason that people, the numbers look artificially low in places like New York and Massachusetts is because they have so much external immigration. I mean, New York City is a place of immigrants from outside the country. Florida is a place of immigrants from inside the country. But if you want an indication of what people who have the opportunity to live in every place are doing, you need only to look at that. So, you know, it's a trade-off. It's a trade-off. But I think that the prospect of consolidation at the local level is far less worrying than at the national level, and increasingly so because we are seeing consolidation like we've never ever seen this before in the bureaucracy in Washington.
One more. Just one more.
Oh, okay.
I'm looking at, I like the fact that you mentioned that people must have their right to be able to determine and not be mandated. But I've seen governance as never existed in such a way. Even being the act of governance itself defeats the purpose of being free to opt out, like tax.
Mm-hmm.
People can't opt out of tax.
Right.
So, and in the sense, when we look at it, that Obamacare is a kind of tax, as it's been postulated, we will also look at it that the real traditions of government itself is based around something that you can't inevitably opt out entirely of. Right. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I'd say two things on that. The first thing is that, and I think having spoken to a few of you earlier, there are some people who are probably much more libertarian than I am. But I'm not making the case for no government. I'm making the case for limited government. So yes, there are always going to be mandates, there are always going to be laws, and they're always going to apply to everybody. But the question before us is, firstly, how many should we pass and how forceful should they be? And secondly, at what level? Can you escape them? Can you get away from them if you don't like them? And if so, is that government likely to repeal the bad ones? Because, you know, if you're in America, you're pretty good. It's much better here than in most places, and that's why a lot of federal laws stay on the book. If they have to be tested against the next door state, they often don't. On the Obamacare point, I would say that, yes, it is a tax, but only because John Roberts rewrote it. I mean, when it was passed, it wasn't a tax. It was a mandate. There was a punishment involved. And that can happen, again, very, very easily. Not only if we're not careful, but if the Supreme Court changes even one vote. I am not an anarchist. You know, I do believe in having a government. But the question one has to answer then is, well, what's the government supposed to do? And I think the Declaration of Independence makes it abundantly clear that the government exists to secure pre-existing rights and to defend people from enemies outside of the country, not from each other. That's the big dividing line here. And what does that mean in practice? Well, it means you have a military, although it exists to defend people in the country and for no other reason. You have a set of laws that put into stone the ancient liberties that pre-existed the United States. And those were property, individual liberties, right to bear arms, which is really the right to self-defense. The right to bear arms is an auxiliary right. The right to speak, the right to assemble, the right to pray, and so on. That will include some force and has to include some force, because if somebody comes to your house and tries to take your stuff, you're going to call the government. But what we have now is so far from that that even getting back to 50% of what it should look like would be a vast improvement.
Yeah. Yep. Let's make it quick, really quick. I know you have a charming piece of cardboard on your desk
at home. Something about rolling back the Magna Carta, the name of conservatism.
Yes.
Along those lines, I think one of your thesis messages tonight was us kind of outreaching to that middle portion of people who don't quite get libertarianism and conservatism. And along those lines, I think people don't quite get the left-right spectrum. And I guess my question is, you've got more of a UK, you know, Britain background as far as your education is kind of giving you more perspective on, you know, the, I'm trying to think, like the Locke and the Voltaire and such and such. Our perspective of left-right seems to go back to 1776 and kind of stop there. You kind of have a more European version of left-right spectrum. Can you explain to us how maybe the left-right paradigm has changed from the European paradigm to the American experiment? And can you also explain how we can best communicate that to people so that they don't say things like, oh, if you want to go super right-wing, you just want Adolf Hitler.
Right.
You know, that.
Well, I said at the beginning that a word has been stolen from those who believe in small government and individual rights, and that word is liberalism. The reason that I say I'm a conservative is really twofold. Firstly, because I believe human nature is fixed. I think that's a central conservative insight. I know many libertarians share it. Progressives certainly don't. But the second reason is that I am progressive. I am conservative of liberalism. And the difference between the United States and, say, Britain or France is that the conservative movement in Britain seeks to conserve an order that was not historically liberal. It seeks to defend the class system, it seeks to defend an established church, it seeks to defend traditional hierarchies, whereas the American system set into place and codified liberal principles. When I think of being a conservative, I wish to conserve that liberal order. It is often met with scorn by the left, this idea, but the analogy I like to use is this. The idea that you can't be a liberal in the old sense of the word if you are conservative of it is as silly as saying that you can't remain married if you're conservative of your marriage. And of course you can. That's the whole point. And that's the big difference that we have. The left in Britain is broadly similar in that it wants to change everything. And the right in Britain is broadly similar in that it wants to conserve everything, but what it's conserving makes a big difference. Now, the advantage that we have here, and I'll finish with this, the advantage that we have here is that it has got so bad in England, and that's not to say England's not a lovely place to be or to live, or people aren't mostly happy, but politically speaking, it has got so bad that no conversation about public policy ever involves the first question, which is, should the government do this? Is this the role of government? And Americans still have that. It is diminishing, but they still have it. And I'll give you this example. About 10 years ago, the government decided that it might be a good idea to put a tracker in everybody's car, which would work out where they had driven, how many miles they had driven, and then send them an electronic bill for a pay-as-you-go road tax. Now, I heard this, funny enough, while driving my car, and almost swerved off the road, because it is quite literally Orwellian. That word is overused, but it is Orwellian. And about 10 minutes after this news had been announced on the radio, they had a debate between the Labour minister at the time, who had proposed it, and a representative from a group called Liberty, which is mostly civil libertarian, although weakly so often. And at no point in her disagreement did she go to the first question, which is, do you think it's a good idea for the government to track every single citizen all the time? She said, it's too expensive, it won't work, what about the satellites, how are you going to retrofit all of these cars? It was an argument purely over practicality. She was conservative in the sense that she didn't want to spend money, not in the sense that she felt as if she was upholding some ancient tradition in which people have pre-existing rights. So there is an advantage in America, but it's an advantage that needs saving. Well, thank you very much for...